Right. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. It is October 26th, and we are here at the Denver Kehillah being hosted by Kohelet for the beginning of our in-person and Zoom learning. It was all Zoom last year, and now it's in-person and Zoom. And last year we started learning Pirkei Avot, and we're going to continue learning Pirkei Avot. But the goal really is to use Pirkei Avot as a jumping off point to talk about big ideas that we find in the Jewish tradition. And as you see from the packet and on screen, there are lots of sources that I prepared. Whether we get to all of them, getting to all of them is not necessarily the goal. I'd rather have an interesting conversation if we don't get to the sources. I see that Jeremiah brought his own. Oh, he brought the Maharal on Pirkei Avot, which is one of the main sources we're going to be studying. So that's great. And if you want to share any insights, and if anyone else has things they want to share from their own versions of commentary on Pirkei Avot or their own thoughts, that would be great. So let's get started. I heard a really, really nice idea this week in a class that I was in, actually, on the book of Ruth. I'm joining with a group of other rabbis learning Megillat Ruth. And someone said that however slowly you are reading the text, read it slower. So that's what we're going to do. We'll have a slow reading. The good news is we have no curriculum or standards to meet in terms of how much ground we cover. So that'll be entirely up to how slow we read. So we could start by, we like I mentioned, we started last year. I'm not sure how far we got. I don't remember. But we're going to start in chapter 1, Mishnah Yud Gimel. That's chapter 1, Mishnah number 13. And that's what you have in front of you. And would someone like to read in Hebrew or in English or both? We'll take a Zoom volunteer or a live volunteer.
I'll go for it.
All right, Brian, thank you.
Hilal v'shamay kibalu mehem, is that slow enough? Hilal omer. Hevei mitomidav shel Aharon, ohev shalom v'radev shalom, ohev et habriyut umekaben latorah.
Great. Okay, so in English, Hillel and Shammai received from them. We're in the them. We're now studying the statements of people called the Zugot. They were pairs of rabbis who were paired together in terms of their teaching. And Hillel and Shammai received from the pair mentioned above them, which we could check out who they were. And Hillel said, "Be of the students or the disciples of Aaron, loving peace and pursuing peace, loving mankind and bringing them nigh," I would have changed that to a more modern word, close, which I could change on the screen, close to the Torah. Okay, so one way we could do this is we could ask around the table and around the Zoomers, anything jump out at you? As interesting or troubling, or any questions that this statement of Hillel or these many statements of Hillel bring up.
You don't mention Aharon as the forefathers, so why is he mentioning them as that we're to be a disciple of?
Okay, excellent. Why is Aharon so special? He's not one of the forefathers. What makes him so special? That's a really, really good question.
Aharon was always a peacemaker or pursuing peace.
So that's what it says here. And along the lines of your question, Rachel, the Maharal actually asked this question, which maybe we'll get to, which is, how do we know this about Aharon? Like, can you point to anything in the Torah where Aharon either loved peace or pursued peace? So it's a similar question that you're asking, like, why Aharon? There are lots of great people in the Bible. And so Hillel has this notion that Aaron loved peace and pursued peace. And we do have rabbinic statements, the midrashim along those lines, but we have nothing in the Torah. Unless the Maharal's wrong, and I'm just the messenger of the Maharal, unless you could think of something, there seems to be nothing in the Torah that indicates that Aaron is the person that Hillel makes him out to be. Yes, Nancy.
Actually, it's Bob.
Bob.
Now, I'm not sure this really works, but and the story of Nadav and Avihu who get punished rather severely for getting the liturgy wrong. And Moses makes the comment that about God's relationship to what has happened to them. And Aaron, who has just lost his kids, doesn't say anything. He remains mute. Okay. And this has troubled me forever. Maybe it's just grief. Maybe he's so shocked by what has happened that he has nothing to say. But I guess in this context, you could say that he doesn't want to cause trouble at this point, that he keeps quiet.
Wow. Okay.
I think that what Moses says to him is really insensitive. That Moses, this is not a time when Moses, and I hate that this in this crowd to knock Moses. Maybe I'm not going to get away with this. But I'm a Reformed Jew, and I don't want to push this too hard. But
you know, Bob, we should all be reforming in some way.
We're all with you. I guess so. But it seems to me that Moses is a little out of line with what he says. But Aaron doesn't say anything. He keeps quiet. He likes peace.
Before commenting on the substance of your remark, I'll just let you know that one of my teachers, Rabbi Yitzchak Greenberg, used to say, maybe he still says it, I don't care what denomination you are, as long as you're embarrassed of it. anyway, whatever that's worth. I do want to say that I think that's a really interesting point, that you're saying that Aaron's decision at that moment to be silent was a way to not stir the pot, so to speak. Now, that's really fascinating because, again, everyone seems to be channeling their inner Maharal. One of the Kohen's jobs, you could argue, is to, good night, Nath, is to make peace between God and the Jewish people. And so it could be that maybe you're onto something. Maybe that's exactly what he was doing by not raising, by not stirring the pot at that point. He was trying to maintain some sort of peace in the camp. Okay, great. Okay, Jeremiah.
If we're thinking about some kind of analogy of be like the disciples of X, in this case, you said that there's a problem with saying that Aaron is the keepsake of peace because we don't have the evidence. The thing that comes to mind of that has evidence maybe is who was Pinchas, who has the covenant of peace.
Right.
After his actions.
Interesting.
But I don't know if that relates. I'm just saying if you're looking for evidence, at least in the Torah, it says he's getting.
Right. God specifically blesses Pinchas with the covenant of peace. But that's really interesting. It could be, I wonder why that is. If you remember the story, Pinchas killed the sinners in the camp, not a very peaceful act. And it could be that God blesses him with peace in the sense that I hope no one comes after you, right, for this. Or maybe this is God's way of saying, you know, sometimes this is necessary, but this should not be your go-to plan whenever you see something going wrong. So it could be that's in a different sense, that God blesses, gives him the covenant of peace precisely because he wasn't peaceful. But you're right. The person in the Bible who we do see associated with Shalom is Pinchas. That's a really great point. Okay. Okay, great. So Rachel raised one question. Anyone else have any questions about and the upshot of that? Will in a few minutes we'll try to get to the Maharal to see how he addresses this question, which is why Aaron is chosen as the model of peace.
I wonder if this is really a question on the right part of the Mishnah, but like, where did Shammai go? Which is like Hillel and Shammai received, but then only it's said only the name of Hillel.
That's a good question. That's a really good question. I have a theory. Anyone else want to suggest a theory before?
It's not what he always does.
Right. Hillel and Shammai were sparring partners, and the Talmud tells us that we generally follow Hillel, except for a few exceptions. And the reason the Talmud tells us that is because Hillel was just more patient and more peaceful than Shammai was. So it could be that this was not Shammai's jam, right? Shammai was not, at the risk of, we've already thrown Moses under the bus, so what's the big deal if we throw Shammai under the bus, right? At the risk of doing that to Shammai, it could be that Shammai wasn't someone, when it says Hillel Omer, I think this is important to note, when it says Hillel Omer, it doesn't mean that Hillel once said this. What it means is this was the essence of Hillel. And the essence of Hillel was spreading peace, and therefore he teaches this. This wasn't the essence of Shammai. And so that's why he's not quoted. It wasn't something that he was known to talk about. So this also teaches us that rabbis used to reuse material. Because Hillel used to say this all the time. Okay, that's a great question. And a great insight into Hillel and Shammai. I saw a really beautiful interpretation of why Hillel, we follow Hillel. Not only was he more patient, but he was more understanding of the human condition and more willing to cut people some slack and recognize that if they don't meet the ideal of what the Torah and what the Halakha ask of them, that's probably because we're just human beings. And there's so many things happen in our life that make it difficult to, we strive for it, but we can't always achieve it. And Hillel was the one who, by giving lenient opinions, was taking that into account and recognizing that the super standard is sometimes not accessible. And then, of course, what goes along with that is if all you provide is the super standard and people can't achieve it, they feel like failures and they won't try again. So there's also an educational element. Okay, two great questions. Any other questions or comments on the Mishnah?
I guess my question is, what does it mean to bring someone close to the Torah? You know, what does that consist of? I've heard different things where people said, oh, you know, for some people, no, they just need the Noahide, you know, laws, or don't teach, you know, Torah to this class of people or to women, or and so here I'm just wondering, so how do you know you've brought someone close to the Torah? What is, how close and how, you know, so it's like amorph is just kind of there. I'm like wondering, well, right, what does that mean to bring someone close?
It's an undefined term.
Well, and also, why is it close to the Torah? Don't want to be close to Hashem.
Like, ooh, wow.
Or maybe the Torah is the link to Hashem. I don't know, but.
Okay, so Rachel's question is, why does it say bring them close to the Torah? Shouldn't we cut to the chase and say bring them close to God? It's a great question. Stacy likes that question too. Great. I think Shammai, I think the Maharal is going to hit on all of these points. Okay, Nancy.
I'm thinking, how can you tell if you're close to Torah or close to God? Because is it behavior? It can't be just belief. It has to be in behavior.
So you're trying to answer Rachel's question. Bring someone close to Torah must mean some sort of is a behavioral element. It can't just be belief. Why not? Why can't it just be belief, Nancy? Unmute yourself. There you
yeah.
Go.
Well, you have to walk the walk, not just talk the talk. You have to show in your behavior that you do love people, that you care about the widow and the orphan, that you understand what it means to follow the law, not just talk about it. Yes, oh yes, I know, I keep this, I do that, but you're not showing that in your daily life. That's what's important, especially for us as Jews. The people of the book need to demonstrate to the rest of the world what the right way to live is. That's what we're about.
Okay. There's a beautiful statement. Beautiful statement in the Talmud Yerushalmi, where God is quoted as saying, I don't know who has the recording of this, but the rabbis have it in the Yerushalmi, where God says, I would rather you not believe in me, but keep my mitzvot. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I leave it out there for you to contemplate. Okay, so we've been reading very slowly. We're 25 minutes in, and we haven't looked at a lot of commentary yet. But it's fine by me. Like I said, there's no curriculum. One last call. Any other comments or questions on this Mishnah? Yes or not?
I actually agree with you. In terms of, and remind me your name, Rachel. In terms of why doesn't it say to get closer to Tzelem Elohim, to be more God-like as opposed to the Torah? So I actually am curious as to why it would do be the Torah.
Okay.
What's so important about disciples? Why not just our own? Why is it all about the disciples?
Another Maharal question. He asks, why not just say Hillel Omer, Ohev Shalom, right? Love peace. Who cares? What's the moniker or the badge that I'm a student of Aaron? Just do it. Right? Why say be a student of Aaron? Why not simply say love peace and pursue peace? Great. Excellent.
Absolutely. Maybe this is probably not a Maharal thing, but like, what are the parameters? Like, you're not supposed to always like that. Like, there are mitzvot in the Torah that are specifically about not pursuing peace. Mm. Like, it's not appropriate all the time. So what does it mean to like?
Okay, so with that, we're going to jump into some of the commentary. That's a perfect segue to the first commentary that I want to show, which is on page 55. The reason why these page numbers are so high is because this is part of a large document of lots of commentary on Pirkei Avot that I'm collecting. So I'm ready up to page 55. This is from Rabbi Norman Lamb, who was the president of Yeshiva University when I studied there. And recently he passed away maybe 2 years ago, right in the middle of COVID. And recently, a beautiful small little book with a beautiful collection of his teachings in Pirkei Avot was published. I highly recommend it. His last name is Lamm, L-A-M-M, if you want to buy it on Amazon. Anyway, he says the following, which is really very much along the lines of what Dalia said. We are bidden to emulate our ancestor, Aaron, who was Ohev Shalom, Virodev Shalom, who loved peace and pursued peace. So Rabbi Lamb is asking here is, what's the difference between loving peace and pursuing peace? And he comes and he quotes an unnamed Hasidic teacher who comes up with a very, what I think is unexpected answer. And let's look at it. Why both, asks the Hasidic teacher, why both love and pursue? Because he answers, both are necessary. When peace is at one with truth, not in conflict with justice, then you, like Aaron, must be an Ohev Shalom, a lover of peace. Like you said, when peace matches up with other values, right? Because if you read this statement in a vacuum, it sounds like Shalom is the only Jewish value. and that's what you should be pursuing. But Dalia picked up on the fact that that may not be the case. But if peace conflicts with truth and detracts from justice, then you must be a rodef shalom, a pursuer of peace, pursuing not in the sense of trying to achieve it, but pursuing in the sense of chasing it away. Right? It's a real twist, really unexpected, in the sense of driving such peace from before you, ahev shalom, ahev shalom, sometimes love it, sometimes chase it away. So, I have thoughts on this, but anyone have a, how does this sit with people? How does this, yeah.
I interpreted it that way. Rodef means to go after it, but not able to get it. To go after something. I see it more as it's, one is where you have, you love it, but you're seeking it, but you can't get it.
So it's actually, that's really interesting. It's suggesting that peace is really unattainable almost, but we nonetheless have an obligation to try.
You don't necessarily catch it.
Right. We can improve things even if we don't necessarily reach the end goal. Okay. Anyone else have a sense of where the word rodef is used? And I'm wondering if this may be where this teaching comes from, although I have no evidence of that.
Somebody was like pursuing somebody to murder.
Okay, said that. So we have two things. We have said that Tzedek in the Torah, which is we should pursue justice, which according to Rabbi Lamb doesn't always necessarily merge or meld with peace. But in rabbinic literature, we have the notion of a rodef who is chasing after you to kill you. Like it's a negative type of chase. And I'm wondering if maybe that's where this comes from. You're chasing it away because you don't want it. Just like you're chasing someone who you don't want to be around anymore to kill them, you're chasing away the peace. So it could be that that's where, again, I have no evidence to this. It just seemed interesting to me that the word rodef is used in both of those ways. But it's a really interesting we said that this is going to be a discussion of some big questions. This is a really interesting question, which is how important is peace?
And what are some good examples of when peace conflicts with truth and attracts justice?
I read a quote, last night or the night before, and it was like, and I wish I could remember who said it, but it was like, neutrality only helps. I wish I could remember the exact words. I was like, neutrality only helps the oppressor, never the oppressed. And it only helps. It was like along those lines, and it kept giving examples.
There were examples. I just think about the civil rights movement, and just think about any type of civil disobedience. They're disturbing the peace because it's at crosshairs with justice, and so that's not peaceful. We could be peaceful and just accept the status quo, even though it's completely unfair to people, and that would make the general society seem more peaceful. But it's not, that would mean that justice is taking a backseat. What's interesting is Rabbi Lamb is suggesting that when you do have a conflict between peace and justice wins, or should win. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's because it's not really peace then. Meaning it may, on the outside, it may seem like peace. On the outside, right, before people in the South were engaged in civil disobedience around civil rights, it seemed peaceful, but it wasn't peaceful for the African Americans, right? There may have been no riots on the street, but it wasn't really peaceful. So it could be maybe that what's going on here is that we say no justice, no peace, but not in the way that it's meant in that statement. Meaning when there is no justice, by definition, it means there's no peace because someone is suffering and that's not peaceful. So maybe that's why the suggestion here is that justice wins over peace because peace doesn't really exist in that situation. Stacy.
Yeah, I was really confronted with this the last couple of days. I've been in St. Louis, and it is kind of the pivotal seat of kind of the United States and kind of slavery, who was going to be a slave state, you know, and who wasn't. And Missouri was kind of the, as they were piecing things back together, Missouri was, it was called the Missouri Compromise, where Missouri could be a slave state and Maine could separate from Connecticut and be a free state. And my ancestor, who is Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky, was called the Great Compromiser. And that's what he did to keep the quote unquote peace in the country, was to make this compromise with Missouri. And so in that, the history looks at that, oh my gosh, the Great Compromiser, but it's like, it's a it really is a compromise of justice,
right,
for the sake of a false peace.
Right. Wow. That's another time I want to hear about the ancestor thing. But wow. Yes, Stacey, thank you. That's a very good example of this. Okay. And thank you for sharing that. Okay. So, I wanted to look at, before we get to some comments of the Maharal, I want to look at one other statement also by Rabbi Lam. This goes back to the question of Hillel and Shammai. Let's see, do I have it? Yes, on page 56, the next page. So, it's not going to answer the question of where the Mishnah got this notion of Aaron being the one who always tries to bring peace, but it does help us understand an important difference between the role that Aaron played and the role that Moshe played. I think it's also a corollary to the Hillel and Shammai difference that I tried to mention before. So this is again from Rabbi Lam. Aaron was a Kohen, a priest. Moses was a Navi, a prophet. While their functions sometimes overlap, in real life, the Navi was somewhat of a Kohen, and the Kohen a Navi, sometimes a Navi. In essence, they are totally different. Prophecy and priesthood often stand at opposite poles. The prophet, as the man of din, of justice, is a radical, like Moses, chief of prophets. He holds fast to his root ideals and insists upon the complete and immediate application of his pure principles without compromise. The priest, as the bearer of rachamim, is a realist, like Aaron. First high priest, he knows the conditions in which his ideals are to be lived. He appreciates the stubbornness of circumstances, the failings of flesh, and the frailty of human nature. The prophet is the angry critic, while the priest is the tolerant teacher. The prophet summons man to God, while the priest pleads with God for patience with man. Moses, the man of din, of justice, hurled at his people the historic divine challenge. Aaron, the man of rachamim, was fatherly guardian of Israel, practiced love and mercy and compassion, even while his people danced about the golden calf. In his passion for justice, Moses smashed the tablets to bits. In his love and forbearance, Aaron picked up the broken pieces of his people and tried to refashion them into a self-respecting nation of God. So this reference to Aaron and the golden calf is at one point, you know, depending on how you read it, Aaron even helped. He understood, and that this is where the people were going, and he even helped them. And so he had rachamim and compassion. And so that is the difference in priest and prophet, according to Rabbi Lam, and why maybe Aaron is this person. And so maybe what Rabbi Lam is suggesting is an answer to the Maharal's question is there is a reference in the Bible to Aaron as being peaceful, and this is it. This is him being the one who, it's true that Moses, when God said he was going to destroy the Jewish people, said, wipe my name out of the book if you're going to do that. But Aaron was the one on the spot, right, who who showed patience with them.
I just remember this. It doesn't even say when Moses died, only the men. Like, I forget. But
Some. As opposed to all.
Whereas when Aaron died, everybody mourned. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also proof that, like, everybody.
There you go. Right. Very good. Very good. Right. Great. Excellent. Okay. All right. Let's get to the Maharal to unpack some of these questions that we've raised. The Maharal is on page 59. Okay. So you see, this was composed somewhere between 1578 and 1588. The Maharal lived from 1512 to 1609. Okay. So here we go. Hillel, sorry, there's no English. I'll translate as we go along. Hillel v'shamai kiblu alehem, quoting the Mishnah, Hillel and Shammai received from them. Eluhem hazuga chamishi, as I mentioned, we're dealing with the pairs. This is the fifth pair. Bo'ol ilmod musar al ikar gadol. He's trying to teach us some ethical teachings about a fundamental principle, a big principle. And this is interesting and maybe a little depressing. Ki ha'olam hazeh hu misugal l'machloket biyoter mikol hadivarim sheba'olam. I think what he's saying is of all the characteristics, of all the ways that we can characterize the world, machloket, disagreement, is the world is more, tends more to machloket than anything else. I'll let you sit with that for a minute. All right, whatever you want to say about the world, what you could say with most certainty is that this world is very, very absorbent, if you will, of machloket, of disagreement.
Yeah, we just translate it like the straight translation of machloket is disagreement or argument.
Yeah. Which I think the Maharal is saying is the absence of peace. Ki zeh inyan ha'olam hazeh shu olam ha'pirud v'hachiluk. That's the idea of this world. It is a world of pirud is separation and chiluk. Another word for separation.
Is machloket ever more of a question than a disagreement?
In the Talmud, it's a disagreement between, but yeah, and yeah. Lakach ha-machloket ragil ba'olam. Therefore, because that's the meaning, what he's saying is the this is the way God made the world. And that should raise the question for us. Like, why did God make the world that is so prone to machloket?
Is he saying the world, like, is he using the world as a stand-in for, like, humans or human nature? Or is it means, like, the actual makeup of everything in the world? Like,
I think human nature. Okay. Yeah, thank you for that. It's a good clarification. I think it's human nature. Anyone want to, before you read on, don't read ahead, anyone want to suggest what he make, how he makes this point? Like, his, what's his proof text to?
I'm in Hevel.
Excellent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, excellent. He says, "The davar zetuchal lahavid ki ba'oto yom shenivra ha'olam baha machloket lo'olam min kayim v'hevel." As soon as the world was created, he says, "On the day the world was created." It's not on the. It can't be on the day that the world was created because humanity wasn't created until later. But. Right, like at the beginning of the creation of the world, the first thing we see, one of the first things we see, is machloket between Kain and Hevel. We even see it before that, between Adam and Chava. Right, they have a disagreement about the should they eat, and then what? As soon as God calls Adam out, what does he say? She made me do it. Right. From this we see that that machloket is suitable for this world because this world is a world of chiluk and pirut, of disagreements and being separate, being not being disunity. Let's call it pirut, disunity. That's like a, to me, like a shocking statement. And then the question is, well, why would God make the world that way? Right? Why? And if you look at it, it seems to me that this chiluk and pirut is like the root of so many terrible things. Right? If things that we're still contending with in our country, that if people would see themselves as not different and not separate, not better, so many things that are wrong wouldn't go wrong. So many ways that people are treated poorly wouldn't happen. But that's not the way that we are programmed. So, and in the, I've seen some other interesting examples of that. I'll just read you one, which I thought was really, really interesting. When, in the beginning of Bereshit, when the Torah starts to teach us about what Gan Eden, to describe what Gan Eden, what the Garden of Eden looked like, if you remember, it said as follows. Let me see if I could find it. V'nahar yotzei me'eden, one river came out of Gan Eden, umisham yifared v'hayala arba rashim. And as soon as it leaves Gan Eden, it sounds like, it breaks out into four. Like, that's the nature of the way things go. There can't be unity.
Well, it's like entropy, right? And the idea that we're all going into chaos.
It
is the nature of the world. Nothing goes back.
Right. Now, so the question though is that true? Is it impossible? We have the notion of a messianic era where all of these differences and wars and disagreements are supposed to go away. So we do believe that we could, you know, put the river back together, right? So to speak. Okay, let's try to answer some of these questions. So the next section where I have those big numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4, those are some of the questions that the Maharal asks, which we've asked already. So let's get to some of its answers. We are on the bottom of page 59. Aval Perush Masha Amar Hevemi Talmidav Shel Aaron. What does it mean to be a student of Aaron? Ki Aaron haya kohen gadol. Now, Rabbi Lam alluded to this a little bit, but Aaron was the high priest, the kohen gadol. How many high priests were there at any given moment?
One.
That's a big deal here, right? Because we're talking about disunity, but Aaron is the one who tried to create unity. And Aaron, this is interesting, Aaron is the only human being living at his time who's the kohen gadol. Even when Moshe was living, there were other prophets, which also may explain why this is an Aaron thing and not a Moshe thing. Because if we're dealing with the ability to bring people together, perhaps it's the person best suited to do it is the person who is just one, just represents that absolute unity. And by the way, who else do we say is one? God. That's also going to play a big role here, right? That God is an absolute unity. Okay. V'Kohen Gadol hu miyuchad liyot mikasher Yisrael. It's the Kohen Gadol who is especially suited to connect the Jews. Ad sheyu Yisrael amechad. So that they could be one. V'zeh kasher hayalahem mishkan echad. Listen to this. Maral, so creative. There was one mishkan, u'mizbeach echad, and one altar. Hefech ha'umot. Different than the other nations. He's talking about other nations that had multiple gods and multiple altars. Again, the difference between multiplicity and one. Kemosha Amru b'Midrash Kasher Hayah Korach Cholek Al Kuhunat Aaron Amar Lehem Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Shalom V'Darkei Goyim Kohenim Harbe. Right? What was one of Korach's arguments? Why is Aaron? We're all holy. And Moshe said, this is not our way. We have one Kohen Gadol. Kula mitkabtsim b'bayit echad. We're all joined together. V'anu ein lanu ela Hashem echad. We only have one God. V'Torah echad. And one Torah. U'mishpat echad. And one law. V'Kohen Gadol echad. And one Kohen Gadol. So this is why Aaron. And so this also answers the Maharal's question. What's the evidence that Aaron was Ohev Shalom? Maharal is saying, we don't need evidence. It was the essence of who he was. The essence of the Kohen Gadol is one, is unity, and he's connecting unity to peace, right? Because when people feel united, then usually peace reigns. So that's how the Maharal deals with why is Aaron singled out here? Because Aaron, because of his spiritual makeup, the Maharal, people say, is like sort of Kabbalistic teachings dressed up in regular language. So there is this like mystical idea of Aaron representing a oneness. It's almost as if Aaron represents the oneness of God on earth. And he could bring that unity to everybody else. Okay. And let's continue a few minutes. Page 60. The ode, Eich yeh mekasher mechaber et habriot ad sheim amechad. Hu ba'atzmo einu mekushar imahem ad sheyeh ohev et habriot. Another question he's trying to answer is also, how do we know that Aaron loved everybody? Like it says in the Mishnah. There's also no indication of that explicitly in the text. Although Rachel makes a good point that when he died, it says that everyone mourned him, which doesn't mean he loved everybody. It means everyone loved him. But maybe it would be hard to get to that if he didn't love everybody. But nonetheless, the Maharal says, how would it be possible to join everyone together im hu ba'atzmo einu mekushar imahem, if he wasn't connected to them? L'fichach amar havemi talmidav shel Aaron, kolomar, me'acher she'aron haya miyuchad ha'musugal hazeh, since Aaron is uniquely qualified to do this. Yoter mikol b'nei Adam, more than anybody else. Im ata usekach, hinei ata nichnas b'zeh v'yot mitalmidav shel Aaron. If you do this, then you're also a student of Aaron. Ki davar zeh ikar etzem madregat Aaron b'mashu ha'yakon gadot. So to answer the question that you asked, why does it say be a student of Aaron? Why not simply say love peace? It seems like what the Maharal is saying is because the Mishnah, the rabbis want to give us a model of what this looks like and how it's possible. And the way it's possible is to love everybody and to treat everyone the way Aaron treated everybody and to be that representative of absolute unity. This is very hard. This is very hard to be able to keep within our own selves so many opposite and respect and love so many opposite and different ways that people live. But God does it. And sounds like the Maharal is saying Aaron is sort of that extension, and Aaron was able to do it. And if you do it, if we do it, then we by definition are his students. Shetarich sheyesh shalom ben ish uben chaveiro, v'chein sheyesh shalom ben Yisrael uben aviyim shabashamayim. When there's peace between people, then there's also peace between the Jews and God. Ubazeh hakol shalom, and then everything is peaceful. V'yada varzeh al yidei Aaron b'frat yoter mikol ba'ei olam. It wasn't that anyone else couldn't do it, but this was specifically something that Aaron was suitable for. U'lefichach im adam nechnas miyot elu nechshav mitalmidav shel Aaron. Now, by definition, if you do this, you're considered a student of Aaron. Ki davar zeh haya la'aron b'mesh haya kohen gadol. This is about him being the Kohen Gadol, which is again that notion of just being one. Okay. Any comments on that? There's I think one or two other things I want to do before we say goodnight, but I want to stop for a second because that's sort of like a really interesting thought piece. that Aaron is this sort of representation of divine oneness, and that's why he was particularly suitable for this job. Any thoughts or comments?
I feel like it must have taken a very special, which obviously Aharon was, to like, if you have like an enslaved nation who was just freed from a, you know, horrible ruler, to then go into another situation where certain people are being elevated above everybody else. Like, it must have taken a very special, and obviously there were divine interventions, like after Korach with the flowering stick, the flowering branch, whatever, but like, it must have just taken a very special person to like overcome that in the nation to have them accept him to be the Kohen Gadol.
That's so interesting. I have never thought of that, right? That after being enslaved, that they were able to accept other human masters over them. That's really interesting. So maybe it's because Aaron and Moshe were so closely associated with God and the miracles done when Bnei Yisrael were freed from Mitzrayim, that like we're seeing here, they really saw them as an extension of God, which is maybe the only way that they would have accepted them, as opposed to any other. Wow, that's really interesting. Maybe that explains so much of our, like, of the Jewish people's unwillingness sometimes to accept, you know, leadership, because there's that scar. That's really interesting. Very profound idea. The Maharal offers something about Rodef Shalom here, which I also think teaches a basic principle. So one basic principle we've seen is that this world is particularly suitable for machloket and disagreement. And my editorial comment on this is, if we, the Torah says we're supposed to imitate God, and if God is one, and that one here means the absence of machloket, then that's something that we are charged to do. Right? We're charged to lower the temperature, right? We're charged to create peace. Although, as we've stated, not all the time. Sometimes you need to upset the peace in order to achieve. Well, you have to upset the peace in order to achieve real peace. So that's our charge as humans who are created in the image of God, and our goal is, as you said, Anat, right, is to constantly cling and try to express that image of God in ourselves as clearly as possible. Well, one of the images of God is peace. One of the names of God is peace. And so that's something we have to do. The second really key principle that the Maharal teaches here is, he says, okay, love peace, but why do I have to chase after it? Chasing after it seems to indicate that it's not so simple. We've already said it's not so simple, but Maharal puts it in very interesting terms. He says as follows: Umashimar Ohev Shalom Ohev Shalom Perush Ohev Shalom Yevo Machloket Ben Hashem. You should love peace, meaning try to avoid disagreement. We're on page 60, right in the middle, right in the middle of the screen. V'rodev Shalom She'im Ba Machloket. Pursuing peace is that if machloket does occur, yudof lasot shalom, you should endeavor or chase after opportunities to make it peaceful. V'sham tzarich redifa, and it requires that we chase after it. Ad shem machzir otam l'shalom, until we could restore the peace. Why? Derech b'nei adam, this is so insightful. Derech b'nei adam kasher nichnesu machloket. What is the general approach when people are in a fight? As kol echad mitrachek min chaveiro v'tachli tarchaka. You go as far away from that other person as possible, whether physically or emotionally. We just cut them out of our lives. Something that's far away and even moving further requires that we chase after it. V'ojit be'er davar zeh mashamar etzel ha-shalom mikol makom redifa davka. V'hu davar muflag mashenikra ha-shalom. V'asur lomar shalom b'gnerchat. You're not allowed to say the word shalom in a bathhouse where presumably people aren't dressed properly. Why? Why can't you say shalom in a bathhouse? Now he says this because one reason is because it's God's name. But he says something else here. The mizet tireki ha-shalom hu inyan kadosh al hakol. Shalom in and of itself is so holy that you can't mention it in a bathhouse. The Maharal goes on to explain, I'll just say it outside, that any the holier the thing, the harder it is to exist naturally. The holier the thing, the more we have to seek it out and chase it out. And he gives some examples. The Torah says, "Ushemartem et ha-mitzvot. In ba mitzvah liyadcha al tachmitzena." If a mitzvah comes to you, don't wait, don't delay. Why not? Because, according to Maharal, because it may not come again, right? The holier something is, like a mitzvah, it's elusive. And so therefore, when you have the opportunity to do a mitzvah, you shouldn't say, I'll do it in 15 minutes, because in 15 minutes it may be gone. Because a mitzvah, it's almost like a mitzvah is like a little cartoon character that's laughing at you. Like, here I am, and if you don't catch me now, I'm going to run away on my little cartoon feet, and I'm going to laugh at you because you're going to have missed your opportunity. Right? So anything that's, so similarly, shalom, which is so holy, proof, you can't say the word in a bathhouse. Because it's God's name that makes it holy. Also, when it's there, you got to grab it. The opportunity to make peace is there. You got to grab it because it may disappear. It's just an interesting idea that the Maharal has. I have to see if he deals with this anywhere in his writing. This notion of the holier something is, the more elusive it is.
Because it's more hidden. Is that what it? You know, you think about Hashem, at least now in nature, is nature is hidden.
Right.
Is that what it is, that peace can be hidden? Is that what it is?
He doesn't use that language, but I think it's similar. He says it's always run. It says running away. Mm-hmm. It's actually maybe even worse because you could see it, but you can't catch it. Mm-hmm. Like Anat was saying, we never quite find it. That's very similar to what you're saying. As opposed to being hidden. But it's a similar idea. You have to, it's effort to do it. It takes effort either to find it or to catch it. I thought that was a really profound way to also explain, like, the difficulties of spirituality and mitzvot and religious commitment. The Maharal is telling us why. Why God made it that way, again, this, I'm not sure. But it's a really interesting idea that mitzvot don't always fall in our lap. And so when they do, we should jump at them. Okay, so that's some of this Mishnah. And we have reached 9:02 already. I apologize for going over time. I just want to mention one other thing, really beautiful idea. The strange language at the end of the Mishnah, which is that Aaron loved habriot and brought them close to Torah. Why say briot? Why just say, like, it seems like it's an uncommon word for human beings. And so on page 58, Rabbi Lamb, a beautiful insight. The love of others can come from many sources. I may love my fellow human because he is human. In a deeper sense, that means I love another human being because I love myself. I see myself in him. There is nothing wrong with that kind of humanistic approach. You shall love your neighbor as yourself implies we must first love ourselves. But there is always the danger that this kind of love exists only when I feel a kinship of some kind between myself and the other. But where there are profound differences of this kind, this kind of love breaks down. Hence, Hillel tells us we must be disciples of Aaron who loved the briot, creatures. He loved others because they were created by God. In loving another human being, he loved God. For the love of the created and creator are intimately bound up with each other in his eyes. And when we love others because they are God's creatures, then no difference can affect that love adversely. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So that's why briot is used. We have this notion, kavod ha-bri. It's a universal term. It's just simply because God created this person, and therefore they deserve that person deserves our love, which fits beautifully into the whole idea of oneness, right? Aaron was one. He was a unifier. God is one. God created us. We're all one. Sorry, say that again.
Oh, say that.
Bob?
Say what you said.
I'm sorry. It kind of emphasizes why the Shema is so central to our liturgy.
Absolutely. Right. Right. This is a beautiful expansion of this, right? It doesn't only teach us that God is one, but if God is one, then there is, by definition, unity in everything that God made. And that includes all human beings. So I thought that was a really nice idea. And with that, we close. And thank you for coming.
And I have a question, Rabbi. Are you going to send out a copy of the text for those of us? Could you email that?
I'd be happy to. Yes, I would not mind if you assume that I forget and you send me an email to remind me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Right, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention earlier, there's an anonymous sponsor for this month of classes. So everyone should know. And sponsorships are available for anyone 1 month at a time for this class. So thank you all for joining and
thank
your
you.
Insightful comments and thoughtful ideas. We will be back next Wednesday, same time, same Zoom channel, and hopefully without a chirping smoke alarm in the room next door. Okay, have a good night, everybody.
Is it okay to take this?
Yes, you certainly can.
And this Shabbat, isn't it at Kohelet?